chapter 4. I emailed to the prayer chain the a timeline for Genesis 5. And hopefully you all got that. If you didn't, I'm going to display it this evening anyway. So we're going to work our way through chapter 4 and then get into chapter 5. And there's just a couple points I want to make in chapter 5, because essentially it's just a list of names and years, and the timeline will help explain that a lot better. So in Genesis 4, Adam and Eve have been booted out of the garden at the end of chapter 3. And we're not given a timeline. We don't know how long they spent in the garden prior to their fall. We don't know how long they spent out of the garden prior to the birth of Cain and Abel. We do know from chapter 5 that Seth was born when Adam was 130 years old. So 130 years have gone by for the birth of Seth. We also know that Cain and Abel at this time in chapter 4 were not the only people. Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters. And we know that from a couple of statements. First of all, Cain is worried about being killed by someone. Well, who's going to kill him if he's the only one left and Abel's dead? So there are other sons and daughters of Adam around. Also, Cain finds a wife, and that's either a sister or a niece, perhaps several times removed. So the chapter 4 is not, there are other people around besides Cain and Abel. The point of chapter 4 is to focus on these two individuals, on their offering to God, on Cain's being rejected by God because of his offering, and then on the first murder, which gets repeated at the end of chapter 4. So the focus, even though there are more people, is on Cain and Abel. And we don't know when Cain was born. We don't know when Abel was born. We simply don't have a time frame, except that Seth is born at 130. So the man had relations with his wife. She conceived, gave birth to Cain. And she names him, I've gotten, now the New American Standard says, I've gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Man-child is just a horrible translation. The word is simply man. I've gotten a man with the help of the Lord. Or the King James, New King James, I've gotten a man from the Lord. And the idea here is Eve is acknowledging the Lord's help in Cain's conception and delivery, especially given the fact that God greatly multiplied her pain in childbirth back in chapter 3. And she's also acknowledging the fact that this one is from the Lord. And I think in her mind, she's thinking, this is the one who's going to crush the serpent's head, that promise back in Genesis 3:15. Now, unfortunately, as Cain grows up and she gets to know him better, she's going to realize how wrong she was there. Again, she gave birth to his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of the flocks. Cain was a tiller of the ground. So, again, these weren't the only children. Verse 14 indicates they're not the only children. Verse 17 indicates they're not the only children. In chapter 5, it says Adam had other sons and daughters. So there are more people running around that are descendants of Adam and Eve. And so Abel here, keeper of the flocks, something that wasn't really anticipated in the garden, though, you know, it certainly permits it. And Cain is a tiller of the ground, and that's exactly what God had assigned Adam to do in the garden, and also after he was expelled from the garden. Adam was going to till the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord. And at some point, both Cain and Abel, and probably everyone else, had learned from Adam and Eve the importance of bringing offerings to the Lord to thank him for his gracious, generous provisions. And Adam, or Cain, brings, it says, an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Now, I want you to, before I go looking into that a bit more, I want you to notice something in verse 4. There's a word in verse 4 that should be, had Cain been doing it right, in verse 3. And I think the reason God later on rejects Cain's offering is because of this one thing. So verse 4, here's what it does not say. Verse 4 does not say Abel, on his part, brought of his flock and of their fat portions. That's what it doesn't say. What it does say is Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock. And throughout the Old Testament, and not just in the Mosaic Law, but in the Chronicles, in Nehemiah, in Ezekiel, in Proverbs, there's an emphasis on the first fruits. And that was one of the problems with Cain's offering. Cain simply brought an offering of the fruit of the ground. It wasn't the first fruits of the ground. Cain simply brought some produce and gave it to the Lord. And that was a problem. So Abel, on his part, brings the firstlings of his flock. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering. But for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. Now, a lot of people teach that the problem with Cain's offering is that it was not a blood sacrifice. And while that may be true, I don't think that's the issue. And for a couple of reasons. What took place in the garden at the hands of God when he sacrificed the animal to clothe Adam and Eve with the skin was a precedent. It was not a precept. It was not a command. God never commanded at that point to bring a blood sacrifice. And if you look at the words that are used for these offerings, they're called offerings. They're not called sacrifices. And a sacrifice would involve blood. An offering may or may not involve blood. And God, these were offerings. These weren't sacrifices. And there are lots of passages in the Old Testament where God not only expects offerings of the first fruits, he requires them. And I think that was probably the issue here, one of the issues, that it wasn't, God didn't disregard Cain's offering because it wasn't a blood offering. He disregarded it because it wasn't a first fruit offering. He simply brought some produce. He kept the best for himself and gave the rest to the Lord. Abel, on the other hand, gave the best and first to the Lord and then kept the rest for himself. And I think there's also another issue, and this comes out when you look at the passage in Hebrews 11. By faith, Abel offered to God. And so Abel's offering was brought from a thankful heart on the basis of faith. Cain's offering was brought from an obligatory heart on the basis of duty. In other words, Abel brought the first fruits or the firstlings of his flock because he was thankful that God had provided them, and he believed that God would continue to provide and multiply his flocks. Cain, he just brought some fruit of the ground. They weren't the first fruits. And the reason he brought them is because he was supposed to. He felt obliged to do this because his parents had taught him to do it. His brother was doing it. It was a duty. There was no faith here. This is something I have to do. I have to perform my duty. Here's some tomatoes. I mean, that's basically what Cain was doing. And so God doesn't regard it. You didn't bring me the first. You didn't bring me the best. You didn't bring it from a thankful heart of faith. You think this is a duty. I'm not impressed. And so Cain becomes very angry. And his countenance fell. His anger was telegraphed by his fallen countenance. He is scowling. He is furious. Remember back in Daniel 3 when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's image, it says he was filled with wrath and his facial expression was altered. He's so angry, his face is contorted. And that response really tells you what kind of man Cain was. And the next few verses, he's going to work it out. Cain was not someone to make things right. He's the type of man who is going to violently lash out at other people that God regarded above him. He's a guy who would hold a grudge even to the point of murder. So the Lord isn't done with Cain. Even though he didn't regard his offering, he's not finished. So he says to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen?" God is graciously seeking Cain out. He still loves Cain. He still cares for Cain. And he's essentially saying to Cain, you have no reason to be angry. You know what to do. It's a simple choice. You've just chosen not to do it. It's not because you lacked instruction. The problem here really is Cain. It's not his offering. Cain had a problem with rebellion. He had been instructed what to do, and he doesn't want to do it. And so God is asking these, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? When I read this, I think of Jonah. You know, he's so angry with God that he didn't destroy the Ninevites. And so God says, do you have good reason to be angry? And Jonah doesn't answer him. And later on, God says, do you have good reason to be angry? And Jonah says, I have good reason to be angry, even to death.
You muted yourself, Jeff. Something happened. We can't hear you. Try it again, Jeff.
Can you hear us, Jeff? You can hear us.
Huh. I just called him.
Yeah, maybe, Jeff, you can call up the number.
Maybe it's radiation from that cloud.
That's a good one, Fred.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Can hear you now.
You stopped at Jonah's anger.
Okay, there must be something wrong with that other microphone. All right. So Jonah's angry, tells God, I have good reason to be angry, even to the point of death. And I think God probably just rolled his eyes there. So God tells Cain, look, if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? So he's basically giving Cain another opportunity to make things right, to present the correct type of offering, the first fruits, rather than just some fruit of the ground, and to do it with a thankful heart, rather than making it some obligation. If you don't do well, be careful, because sin is crouching at the door. He's basically telling Cain, you need to beware. Sin is crouching at the door. It's like a lion waiting for you to step through, and then it's going to pounce. But you must master it. Do not let it master you. So he's saying, you've got a choice. You can do well or not do well. You can choose fellowship with me or separation from me. You can choose a blessing or a curse. You can choose life or death. And the problem here is Cain. It wasn't the offering. Cain is a defiant, he's a rebellious, disobedient individual. And the offering was simply a symptom of that problem. And so God is giving Cain an opportunity to change that. And if the change happens, then the offering is going to change as well. So Cain, and the next verse really depends on your translation. Some translations say Cain told his brother Abel. In other words, he and Abel probably had a conversation about what happened with Cain and God, and Abel, I'm sure, encouraged his brother, just do the right thing. Other translations say, Cain said to his brother, let's go out to the field. So they end up going out to the field, and Cain rises up against Abel, his brother, and kills him. So here, Cain chose not to do well. Instead of taking God's offer to make things right, instead of changing the attitude of his heart, Cain kills his brother. And I think in Cain's mind, he's thinking, you know, if the Lord's not going to accept me or my offering, then he's not going to accept my brother and his offering either. That's the kind of man Cain was. So God says to Cain, where's Abel, your brother? And keep in mind, the Lord's not asking the question because he somehow lost track of Abel. Or, you know, I don't know where Abel is. He knew exactly where Abel was. And he's basically asking this question of Cain to elicit a confession. He wants to get Cain to testify against himself. Just like in the garden, when God said to Adam, where are you?
God knew where Adam was. He wanted Adam to admit it. Same thing here. He knows where Abel is. He wants Cain to admit what he did. And so Cain, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? I think he was expecting a no answer there, but the fact of the matter is and was, yeah, you are your brother's keeper. And as Moses writes this, and as he works his way through the Pentateuch, that idea of being your brother's keeper is going to work its way out. The avenger of blood was the next kin, the brother of the person who was murdered, or the whole idea of the liberate marriage. If your brother dies childless, you, as your brother's brother, marry his wife and raise up children for your brother. So yeah, you are your brother's keeper. And Cain, he refuses to admit what he's done. I don't know where he is. I'm not my brother's keeper. And so God says, what have you done? And he doesn't let Cain answer, because Cain's not going to answer anyway. The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. Cain's not going to admit it. He's not going to confess. He's not going to repent. So God tells him, your brother's blood is testifying against you. And now you are cursed from the ground. Back in Genesis 3, God tells Adam, cursed is the ground because of you. Now he tells Cain, you are cursed from the ground. The ground that opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. He implicates Cain there. His culpability is emphasized. This is a direct accusation. The ground has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. And now you are cursed from the ground. And this is the first time that an individual is cursed. Adam and Eve weren't cursed. The ground was cursed. Now Cain is cursed. And so God tells Cain, when you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. So in Genesis 3, God tells Adam, the ground is cursed because of you, and it's going to produce thorns and thistles, and you're going to toil over it by the sweat of your face, and it's going to be hard work. And now he's telling Cain, when you attempt to till the ground, not only is it going to yield thorns and thistles in abundance, it's not even going to yield its strength for you. You're going to work and toil, and you're going to have next to nothing to show for it. It's going to be an exercise in futility. There's not even going to be a point to farming. You're going to be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. You are cursed away from the ground that you used to till. And I think if farming was difficult for Adam, it's going to be impossible for Cain. And so he says, you're going to be a vagrant. Don't even waste your time farming. You're not going to get anything. You're going to be a vagrant. You're going to be a wanderer on the earth. And so Cain says, my punishment is too great to bear. And there's lots of variations in the way this statement is translated. I personally think this is the best translation given the character of Cain. There's no remorse. There's no regret. Cain is only concerned about Cain. And his only thought is for himself and the punishment that the Lord has just meted out to him. This punishment is too harsh. I only killed my brother. You're sentencing me to a life of wandering. I mean, that's the kind of reasoning that's going in Cain's mind. How can you do this to me? And God could have said, well, how could you do what you did to your brother? So Cain says, you've driven me this day from the face of the ground. You banished me from the ground I used to till. And from your face, I'm going to be hidden. You've banished me from your presence, which really isn't true. But Cain does go out from the presence of God. I'm going to be a vagrant and a wanderer. So you banished me from my livelihood. You've banished me from your presence. You've banished me from the community I've lived in. You sentenced me to be a vagrant, to be a wanderer on the earth. And whoever finds me is going to kill me. Well, Cain is now afraid that someone is going to do to him what he had just done to his brother. And who is he referring to? Well, these would be the other brothers and sisters and their progeny. Someone is going to hear what Cain had done to Abel, and someone is going to seek to avenge Abel's murder. And so God intervenes here. This is God showing mercy to Cain. And he says to Cain, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. Cain deserved to die for the murder of his brother. But God shows him mercy, and he assures him that even though you didn't regard your brother's life, I regard your life. And even though you deserve to die, I'm not going to allow it. And anyone who dares to kill you, I will exact vengeance on him sevenfold. And so God appoints a sign for Cain. Most translations say that God put a mark on Cain. Unfortunately, that's not very accurate. It's not a mark that was necessarily put on the body of Cain. The word used there is simply a sign that's given to Cain or for Cain, not necessarily on Cain. So God did something, and what he did, we don't know. You know, maybe he put a tattoo on his forehead or branded him somehow or did something to indicate that this man is under the Lord's vengeful protection. What that sign, what that mark is, we don't know. You know, there's lots of speculation. I'm not going to get into the speculation, but God appoints a sign for Cain so that no one finding him is going to kill him. So Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. Now, God told Cain, you are going to be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. And Cain says, nope, not going to happen. He settled. He goes out from the presence of the Lord and settles in the land of Nod. Now, what's interesting about Nod, in Hebrew, the ancient Hebrew scriptures were only written in consonants. There were no vowels. Okay? So the land, the word Nod is three Hebrew consonants, and they are the exact three Hebrew consonants for wanderer. So there's kind of a play on words here. Cain settled in the land of the wanderer. Nod and wanderer are spelled identically with the same three Hebrew consonants. So where he settled was the place of the wanderer. The one who should be wandering disobeyed God again and is now settled. And he has relations with his wife, and this would have to be a sister or a niece, or you know, a niece probably several times removed. And he gives, or she gives birth to Enoch. Don't confuse this Enoch with the Enoch in chapter 5. So she gives birth to Enoch, and Cain builds a city, so much for wandering and being a vagrant, and names the city Enoch after his son. And then Enoch has Ered, and Ered has Mahujael, and Mahujael has Methushael, and Methushael has Lamech. So basically, we've gone seven generations in that verse. So two names here, Enoch and Lamech. Don't confuse these two guys with the Enoch and Lamech in chapter 5. They're not the same people. So Lamech takes two wives. So he decides to ignore God's precedent in Genesis 2, so much for the husband of one wife. He takes two wives. So he's the first recorded polygamist in the Bible. And his wife, Ada, gives birth to Jabal, and he becomes the father of nomadic herdsmen, people who dwell in tents and have livestock. And then she has another son, Jubal, and he's the father of the musicians. And then Zilpah has a son, Tubal-Cain. He's the forger of implements of bronze and iron, and given the digression of the human race into chapter 6, those implements of bronze and iron were probably weapons. And then the sister of Tubal-Cain is Naamah. She didn't have an occupation. Lamech, he follows in the footsteps of his great-great-great-great-grandfather, something like that, Cain, and he commits murder. And he writes a poem about it. So basically, this statement here in verses 23 and 24, it's a poem. It's a song. And you'll notice in Hebrew poetry, there's what's known as parallelism. And parallelism is the repetition of a statement, but worded slightly differently. So for example, the parallel statements here, Ada and Zilpah, you wives of Lamech. Listen to my voice, give heed to my speech. Now, the next statement is also parallel. It says the same thing. I have killed a man for wounding me and a young man for striking me. You can't read those as two separate statements. They're parallel statements. They say the same thing. So, Lamech didn't murder two people. He murdered one person. Just like Ada and Zilpah, you wives of Lamech, are two parallel statements. Listen to my voice, give heed to my speech, are two parallel statements saying the same thing. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me, are parallel statements saying the same thing. So Lamech murdered somebody for striking him. Whether it was accidental or on purpose, he overreacts. And he murders the guy. And then he boasts about it to his wives and actually composes a poem to commemorate it. And then he's got the audacity to say, if Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. I'm more important than Cain. I think he failed to realize that in Cain's case, it was God who announced the penalty for vengeance against Cain. Lamech doesn't get to make that announcement. And God certainly isn't going to make the announcement for him, and he's certainly not going to protect him with a sign. So Cain or Lamech is even more arrogant than Cain was. So Adam has relations with his wife again. She gave birth to a son, named him Seth. Now chapter 5 tells us Adam and Eve are 130 years old at this point. And Eve says, God has appointed me another offspring in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. So she's reminded of her murdered son, and she's reminded of how he died. My other son killed him. And to Seth is born Enosh, or Enosh. And if you look over in chapter 5, verse 6, Seth has Enosh when he's 105 years old. So lots of time goes by between these verses. So between verse 25 and 26, 105 years have gone by. And Moses ends this chapter by saying, then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Up to this time, Abel called upon the name of the Lord. Certainly Adam and Eve called upon the name of the Lord. But there's no indication that any of the line of Cain called upon the name of the Lord. And the calling upon the name of the Lord is now being carried out by Seth and his descendants. But even there, I would be careful about creating what some people call the godly line of Seth. And we'll discuss that when we get into chapter 6. So chapter 5, and here is where I'm going to share the screen. This is the timeline that I want us to consider. and there's just there's just a couple of things I want to point out. In the beginning of this chapter, the first two verses, Moses simply rehearses creation. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In chapter 6, he's going to talk about the records of the generations of Noah. In chapter 10, he's going to talk about the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. In chapter 11, he's going to talk about the records of the generations of Shem. But this is Adam. These are Adam's descendants through Seth. And in the day God created man, he made him in his likeness, repeating Genesis 1:26. He created them male and female, repeating Genesis 1:27. He blessed them, repeating Genesis 1:28, and named them man. That statement's not found. They were just called Adam, man, kind of in general. And then when Adam was 130 years old, He became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image. Now, remember when we discussed in Genesis 1, image and likeness. Image carries with it the idea of being a representative. So when Adam was created in the image of God, he represented God. Likeness has the idea of being a reflection. Adam reflected some of the attributes of God. He represented God. Now Adam has a son in his own likeness, in his own image. So Seth is a reflection of Adam. Seth is going to become Adam's representative. And then he had other sons and daughters. So in the chart, Adam lives to be 930 years old. And I want you to notice some things in this chart as we go along that, for example, Seth died 6 years before Noah was born. I find that kind of interesting. Methuselah died in the same year as the flood. That's kind of cool. But if you go after the flood, look at how long Shem lived. Shem lived 600 years. And then jump down to Abraham. Shem lived 30 years longer than Abraham lived. Abraham died 30 years before Shem. Okay, so some of those things are actually kind of interesting. In this chart also, you'll notice there's a guy with a question mark after him. The son of Arpachshad, Canaan. He's only found in Luke 3. And Luke got that name out of the Septuagint, not out of the Hebrew. How it got into the Septuagint, I have no idea. So somehow the Septuagint added a name that's not found in the Hebrew text. Just kind of a side note. jump down, and not a whole lot is really said about most of these guys. If you jump down to verse 21, we come to Enoch. And Enoch is the seventh generation after Adam. So Enoch here would be the same generation as Lamech from chapter 4. All right? So Enoch, it says, and notice before we get here, at the end of each of these sections, three words, and he died. Every one of them, and he died, and he died, and he died. Here's where you see the penalty for eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil being worked out. They're all dying, except Enoch. So Enoch walked with God. To walk with God is to have fellowship with God. It's to faithfully obey God. It's to commune with God. There's the idea of intimacy with God, devotion to God. And it's kind of reminiscent of what Adam and Eve experienced in the garden prior to the fall. They walked with God in the cool breeze of the day. Enoch walked with God, had other sons and daughters. And verse 24, Enoch walked with God. And at some point, God said, you know, why don't you come home with me? And verse 24, God took him. Everyone else, and he died. Enoch, God took him. You go on, you got Methuselah, you come to Lamech, verse 28. And Lamech is the father of Noah. And so Lamech, when Noah is born, says, this one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord cursed. Noah's name means rest. This one, whom I'm going to call Rest, is going to give us rest from our work. So he's looking to perhaps some respite from the curse. And then we come to Noah, and Noah's 500 years old, becomes the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. No mention of other sons and daughters. Now, there's something, I think, kind of a side note. When we read through all of the mentions of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and in all of the lists of names throughout the Old and the New Testament, Shem is always mentioned first. And Japheth is mentioned last. But that's not their birth order. Genesis 9 tells us Ham was the youngest. And given what Genesis 11 says about Shem having a child after the flood, Shem was the middle one. Shem was actually born when Noah was 502. So Japheth is the oldest at five, when Noah's 500. At 502, Shem is born. Sometime after that, Ham is born. So they're not given in their birth order. And that really shouldn't surprise us. Usually in the Old Testament, the one in the chosen line or the blessing line is mentioned first before the firstborn, like Isaac over Ishmael, Jacob over Esau, Judah over Reuben, and in fact, Joseph over Reuben, David over Eliab. So they're not always given in their birth order. These long lifespans, if you notice this, most of these guys lived into the 900 years. Enoch lived the shortest, but he never died. So the shortest lifespan of all the antediluvians would be Shem at 600, and he died after the flood. Noah died after the flood. And then lifespans become centuries shorter very quickly, so that by the time you get to Joseph, he lived just to be 110 years old. People today live to be 110 years old. So things changed. Now, in the millennial kingdom, according to Isaiah 65, those long lifespans are going to become the norm again. Isaiah says, no longer will there be an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not live out his days. The youth will die at the age of 100, and the one who does not reach the age of 100 will be thought to be accursed. So the lifespan curse is going to be reversed in the millennial kingdom. Next week, we're going to look at Genesis 6. Genesis 6 is probably one of the more difficult chapters to interpret, because there's lots of things that are open to speculation. And I'm not going to go into all of the different theories. We simply don't have time for that. I'm going to give you my idea. You may have a different one. We can arm wrestle over it and see who wins and go from there. But Anybody have any questions on this material?
Jeff, this is Ray. So can you just briefly talk about, again, the end of the portion that talks about, and then men began to call on the Lord? Or another translation says, began to use the Lord's name in worship. What exactly, why is that there?
Well, I think up to this point, you know, that simply wasn't taking place on a regular basis. So you've got the Cainite line, and that simply, it appears, never happened. I shouldn't say never, but for the most part, nobody of Cain's line bothered to call on the name of the Lord. It wasn't until the line of Seth through Enosh that people actually began to call upon the name of the Lord. They actually started following what Adam and Eve had been telling them to do. And so this is the point where people are going back to their roots. They're finally doing what they were supposed to do all along. And given the time frame here, 200 years have gone by, and people are just now beginning to call upon the name of the Lord. So I think they're finally understanding that the only way we're going to get any rest or peace is by fellowshipping with the Lord. I think they're coming to that realization. Without him, there's no rest, there's no peace, there's just turmoil.
Jeff, then the second part of my question is, naming Noah or rest, any thought as to what his father had in mind? I mean, did he just will for rest to happen, or did he have some?
Yeah, I think that was his hope. It certainly didn't happen. Noah, I guess in a sense he did bring rest, because all of the wickedness was essentially wiped off the face of the earth. But up until the flood, there was no rest. There was, you know, you look at chapter 5 and he talks about corruption and wickedness and evil and violence, and it was that way continually. So, you know, the first 600 years of Noah's life, there was no rest and there was no peace. And it wasn't until the flood that finally there was rest. And I can't imagine that Lamech would have thought that's what he had in mind. And very soon after that, you've got everything going back to the way it was. You get to the Tower of Babel and, you know, more defiance, more rebellion against God, more disobedience. So, yeah, I think his naming Noah was more wishful thinking than anything else.
Jeff, I was wondering, this is Neil, if you could explain the part about how you said Cain's attitude was wrong. What in the passage kind of makes you say that? Other than that he didn't give the first.
Well, I would say that the way he responded, you know, God offered him correction. He offered him an opportunity to get it right. And He's angry, very angry. His countenance has fallen. He refuses to take advantage. I mean, all he had to do was go and get the first fruits and offer it to God. Instead, he kills his brother. So there was a whole attitude problem that I think the reason for his offering was his attitude toward God, especially the way he responded to God afterwards. I think that his response was not something new. It was the way he was.
Okay.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of Ananias and Sapphira, a little bit, you know, where they're an improper attitude about not giving God what he, you know, holding back.
Yeah, and then lying about it.
Right.